Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Caracas, Venezuela, for an update on the return of President Hugo Chavez from Cuba, where he underwent a fourth round of cancer surgery. Virginia Lopez, who covers Venezuela and Latin America for the UK Guardian and Sky Television, joins us to discuss the lack of details about the health of Venezuela's president, who was supposed to be inaugurated last January, and the lack of press access to Chavez's secret arrival, except for his personal tweets to his 4 million Twitter followers. Then we will speak with Nada Hashimi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. We will discuss what can be interpreted from the mudslinging ahead of Iran's June elections coming out of the rival camps of the outgoing president and the speaker of Iran's parliament. Rhetoric so heated that it forced the supreme leader to publicly rebuke President Ahmadinejad and Speaker Ali Larijani. Then finally, we'll examine the latest UN report on Syria that finds the war that has cost 70,000 lives so far is becoming increasingly sectarian, prompting Carla Del Ponte, the UN human rights investigator, to tell the UN Security Council it is time to refer the issue of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Joshua Landis, who writes the daily newsletter and blog on Syria, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss the war within the war between the Sunni extremist al-Nusra militia and the extremist Shiite militia Hezbollah. And joining us now from Venezuela is Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky Television. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
And how are you?
Very well, thanks. And President Hugo Chavez apparently arrived back in Venezuela from Cuba, where he has been undergoing his fourth round of surgery for cancer. He arrived at 2:30 in the morning and was taken directly to a military hospital in Caracas. And this is in contrast to his previous trips to Cuba and returns, which were televised, etc. This is done under secrecy. So what do you know about his condition?
Well, we don't know too much, or at least not from official sources. The comments here have ranged from, you know, he's come home to die, or he's actually doing much better than we expected. There were comments from a governor who's a Chavista supporter or a Chavista saying that actually Chavez had walked into the military hospital. But again, nothing can be proven because there was no, like you said, no footage or no photographic record of his arrival or his entry into the hospital.
And apparently all that is being released by the government are, four tweets from Hugo Chavez's Twitter account that has 4 million followers. It's been dormant for a number of months. And then, of course, the vice president went on early morning television with a phone call, being very ebullient, saying that Chavez is an example of permanent battle. And here we have him in Caracas, in our Caracas, in our Venezuela. Here he is, our comandante. It's pretty hard for somebody that follows American politics to get a handle on that kind of worship of a leader. We're pretty cynical about our leaders here. I take it that there's a lot of love and affection for this leader.
Certainly. And I think that, you know, we will look at, in hindsight at this period as one that was definitely characterized by a cult of personality, though with Chavez. He's an incredibly charismatic leader. And certainly his supporters, you know, worship him. These last 2 months of absence have been, you know, filled with all sorts of almost religious worship towards Chavez and a huge show of not only faith that he would recover, but also sort of undying devotion towards his persona. I think, you know, he's certainly sort of almost considered at the sort of like semi-god level by many Venezuelans here. But of course, it's such a polarized society that sort of certainly the other half or the opposition, many in the opposition see him with the same sort of cynicism that many Americans feel towards their leaders.
Well, apparently the VTV, the government television station, which is essentially a propaganda arm of the government, the information minister, Ernesto Villegas, led a celebration, bringing out all of the TV station staff onto the set chanting, "He returned, he returned, he returned." Did you see that?
I didn't see it, but I read about it. Yes, it was sort of, yeah, it was quite weird. It was almost reminiscent of Tom Cruise jumping on a chair when he was on TV.
So, well, I got to get that image out of my head. Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Venezuela. She's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian, the UK Guardian, and Sky Television. So tell us about this protest that's taking place. It's in the last few days where 21 students have chained themselves together in protest in front of the Cuban embassy in Caracas. Well, what are they protesting? It's obvious that they're making a point by going to the Cuban embassy.
Well, they've been protesting that President Chavez has been, you know, undergoing surgery or prolonged cancer treatment in Havana, and certainly protesting the fact that the information that we've received has been at best vague. The reports have been, I would say, frequent, but not necessarily, offering too much clarification with regards to things like, you know, whether Chavez will be fit to govern or not. And we've seen him miss his big inauguration day on January the 10th with not too much of an explanation given as to, you know, why he was missing it, other than, of course, that he's, you know, gravely ill, but not... no plan for the future or no expected date of return until, of course, today, which came as a huge surprise to everyone. But, you know, certainly it comes as a surprise that there seems to be no plan for the future, or not one that's been articulated for most of the people here.
Well, apparently, my understanding is that given that the Supreme Court ruled that President Chavez could delay his inauguration indefinitely, the country is essentially being run by the vice president, Maduro, but the opposition are arguing that Cabello, the National Assembly president, should be running the country. So what's going on with that battle, succession, if you will, before the corpse is cold?
The opposition has certainly tried to frame it as a battle within the Chavismo, and they've hinted at the fact that there's actually sort of a power struggle within Chavismo. I don't know that there is or there isn't, but the Chavismo has made a huge effort to show a public image of complete unity. And there's actually, you know, abundant footage of Maduro and Cabello hugging in public and, you know, appearing as a united front. So again, you know, it's hard to say whether there's an internal dispute within Chavismo or who exactly is running the country in light of Chavez's absence. There's also huge criticism from the opposition that most of the decisions seem to be made in Cuba and under the strict guidance of the Castro brothers. So yes, on one hand, a huge level of indignation from the opposition, but on the other hand, I would say almost a sense of apathy, like life goes on and this hasn't really changed the lives of Venezuelans in one way or the other, or certainly not as much as sort of the daily battle to find food or you know, the effects of a devaluation a couple of days ago.
Now, that was a pretty substantial devaluation, wasn't it?
It was, it was close to 40%. Hmm. It went from 4.30 to 6.30.
It did to the dollar?
Yes. 4 bolivares 30 cents to 6 bolivares 30 cents to the dollar, yes. And this is, of course, the official exchange rate, but because of all of the strict currency controls, unfortunately, there's this whole black market that has appeared with huge amounts of all sorts of discrepancies and corruption. It's been also 10 years of currency controls with all of the distortions that usually come along with these types of currency controls.
Well, Virginia Lopez, again, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian and Sky Television. You mentioned the puzzlement over the role of, or the objection to the role, the considerable role of the Castro brothers in Venezuelan affairs. In general, as an outsider, I find it kind of incomprehensible that Venezuela, which is a very wealthy, oil-rich country with a lot of resources South America, is in many ways, it appears to be politically subjugated voluntarily to this tiny little island failed state of Cuba that, if it weren't for Hugo Chavez giving Castro oil, I think the Cuban economy would have totally collapsed. So I'm just curious of the, as the disproportionality of this, that the idea that the leader of a relatively powerful Latin American country would, you know, essentially appear to be taking his orders from the brothers of this failed state that's being kept alive by Venezuelan oil.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's hard to comprehend for everyone, I think. You know, there's been comments here that, especially some, you know, for a presidential period that has characterized itself for, you know, talking constantly of sovereignty, that, you know, all of a sudden, like you said, it feels like Venezuela's decisions are so, you know, subjugated by the Castro brothers' will. You know, it does feel ironically like we're almost, you know, like Cuba's Puerto Rico, in a sense. I don't think I have an explanation. If I go by what President Chavez himself has said, it seems that it's the result of him feeling that Fidel Castro is very much a father figure to him, and that for some reason the Venezuelan process of the last 14 years is modeling itself after the Cuban Revolution. But of course, you know, it really has nothing to do with it. And like you said, Venezuela is an oil-producing country. It sells most of its oil to the U.S., So yes, no, the contradictions abound, and it's very hard to get your head around this strange father, you know, son relationship that isn't.
So, as a member of the Venezuelan press, what are you and your colleagues going to do in the next few days to try and find out about the real state of the health of your president? And in general, you know, whether there's going to be a succession, who's in charge, et cetera. I mean, these are pretty fundamental questions.
I'm not too sure. I assume some of us will try and sneak into the military hospital and try and get, you know, comments from nurses and that kind of thing that we journalists tend to do at times. And I guess we'll just wait for official announcements as well. Like I said, you know, the information has been at best vague, and so, you know, but it's what we've got to go with. This whole illness has been treated with the utmost secrecy in Cuba. It was, you know, it was quite easy to keep the secretiveness of the whole illness. I'm not sure if here in Venezuela we've changed so much in the last 14 years that the secret will be kept. We're not a society that is known for keeping secrets. So I'm not sure exactly if the story's going to get any better, or if for some strange reason or unpredictable reason, it will go on record and say what the plan for the next couple of months are. If Chavez were to be sworn into office and then resign, the Constitution calls for a snap election within 30 days. This is one of the scenarios that the experts have contemplated that could happen. But like I said, it's also uncertain that we could easily see a recovered Chavez assume the presidency for his fourth presidential term and go on to govern for a couple of months or even years. Villegas, on the last sort of official report on Chavez's health on the 15th, did say that his sort of almost exact words were that the base illness was continued to be treated in an energetic manner. And so this base illness, which is cancer from what we know, seems to continue being a cause for concern. But again, you know, I don't know what the treatment has been. We don't know exactly what type of cancer President Chavez is being affected by. So I don't have a clear answer for that.
Just in closing, Virginia Lopez, if indeed it is terminal and he's come home to die, I imagine that if and when that happens, it will be an extraordinary traumatic moment for the country, because you were talking earlier about the kind of worship so many people have for Hugo Chavez. Probably that will carry his legacy on for some time, won't it?
Oh, yes, yes. I think it's pretty safe to say that it'll be definitely a spectacular event in Venezuelan history. You know, and again, people here have predicted that we'll enter into a sort of like a post-Perón era, where, you know, even after Perón, Peronismo still exists. And of course, you know, that Chavez, like Juan Perón in Argentina, will also be buried in this sort of spectacular public, you know, event that will last for days, and that will be, you know, an outpour of emotion. But, you know, Chavez is known for defying all predictions. So again, I don't know. But yes, I think it's safe to say that his legacy will probably live on for a while. I don't know how it will be evaluated in the long run, but certainly now there's a huge, you know, emotional bond that he's very successfully built amongst, you know, a majority of Venezuelans.
Well, of course, as we've discussed before in previous interviews, Virginia Lopez, that I'd heard from some, you know, intelligence sources that he definitely had terminal cancer, and the secrecy only reinforces that idea. Surely, I mean, I don't understand the reason for the secrecy. If, as we all know, he has cancer and he's had four operations, and gone to Cuba for treatment. That if they were leveling about it and saying exactly what was going on and that he was going to get over it, as some people do, although this is apparently metastasized and gone into his pelvis, starting out as prostate cancer, the secrecy more or less reinforces the idea that he's not going to survive, and they're just delaying the inevitable.
Yeah, it could be seen that way. Though somebody was telling me that at some point during, you know, the 50 plus years of Fidel Castro in power in Cuba, at some point he disappeared because allegedly, you know, he was too suffering from cancer. So again, I actually have tried to find this, but I haven't been able to. So I'm not sure that this story that I was told is actually true. But this. There is a sort of a level of mastery through mystery to this whole style of governance. So I don't know. I mean, my tendency is to think that the government hasn't lied about the severity of Chavez's illness, but the truth is that a lot of it has been kept secret, or, like I said, you know, sufficiently vague that it has. The whole world speculating. This is a news that has captivated the whole world. It's quite incredible. But yeah, no, I mean, I hate to say this, but I so often answer these questions by saying I don't know, which is so strange.
Well, but that's the that's because your government's not telling you anything. So not surprising, but. Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Venezuela. She's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky Television. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the mudslinging going on in Iran ahead of the June elections.
سلسله کوه البرز، وسعت نام تو، وسعت نام خورشید، جلوه خاک تو، قرمز و سبز و سپید. این نوانم من، نوان منم من، ذره خاک وطنم من، ذره خاک وطنم من، ایرم خاک در ایرم.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
And there's an extraordinary amount of mudslinging going on ahead of the Iran's June elections, coming out of the rival camps of the outgoing president and the speaker of Iran's parliament. And this, of course, has forced the supreme leader to publicly rebuke President Ahmadinejad and to scold somewhat more, less the speaker, Ali Larijani. Is this unusual? I mean, if not unprecedented?
I mean, it is unusual, particularly given the fact that the mudslinging that we're seeing taking place are happening within the hardline conservative constituency within Iran, who rallied together 4 years ago to crush the democratic aspirations of the Iranian people and the rise of the Green Movement. So what we basically have seen is an internecine sort of factional rivalry being played out in front of the entire nation. And just to give you sort of an example of what happened last week, to draw a parallel, the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, went before the parliament and in the middle of his public speech sort of played a videotape that allegedly showed the brother of the speaker of the parliament engaging in sort of a backroom deal with several high-ranking members of the Iranian political regime in exchange for political sort of kickbacks and an attempt to sort of expose and damage the reputation of the Speaker of Parliament. I mean, to draw an analogy with the United States, it would be as if President Obama, in the middle of his State of the Union address, were to, you know, show a videotape that revealed the brother of John Boehner engaged in some sort of backroom sort of economic sort of wheelings and dealings to advance their own private economic interests. So this has sort of greatly damaged the, you know, image and the reputation of all politicians who are active in Iran right now. And the supreme leader, whose job is to preserve stability and order, has publicly rebuked both parties for damaging the reputation and the integrity of Iran's political system. And, of course, this is all happening because there is supposed to be another presidential election in June, and all sort of political constituencies, the two main camps that are active publicly in Iran, the camp of Ahmadinejad and the camp of the supreme leader, for which the Speaker of Parliament is allied with the supreme leader, basically two camps, are really publicly sort of fighting over the future of the Islamic Republic.
So where does the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards Corps, who's supposed to be the power behind the throne, where are they in this battle between Ahmadinejad and the Speaker Larijani?
Yep.
Because I know that Ahmadinejad has got connections to the IRGC, but also the Supreme Leader's son, Motion, also does. So I'm a little confused.
Yeah, I mean, the senior commanders of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps, the Revolutionary Guards, in other words, they are all handpicked and selected and rotated regularly by the office of the supreme leader. So they are all, at least the senior leadership, the senior officer corps, they are all deeply loyal to the office of the supreme leader and increasingly critical of Ahmadinejad, who really now is acting as sort of a rogue element here. I mean, it's important for your listeners to realize that just because Ahmadinejad is the president of Iran, he doesn't have the same political powers as the president of the United States does. The power in Iran is fundamentally sort of enshrined, and it's located in the office of the supreme leader, who really has complete sort of power, if he chooses to wield it, to intervene in any aspect of of politics in the interests of preserving the Islamic Republic of Iran. So Ahmadinejad is a very weak sort of player, but because he does have an office of the presidency, he does have access to the state media, he does have a lot of resources at his disposal, which can sort of make life very complicated, and he can embarrass those of his rivals, and that's what he's seeking to do in the last few months of his political office.
But it also seems, Nader Hashemi, that he's also embarrassing the Supreme Leader, and maybe that's what he's trying to do here, because the Supreme Leader is apparently guilty of a lot of poor judgment. And is this what's going on, that this is Ahmadinejad's strategy?
I think so, yeah. I think what's happening is that Ahmadinejad and his supporters have been suffering from delusions of grandeur, that they, you know, really do have power within Iran's political system and also on the global stage, and they're trying to continue that legacy. Now that Ahmadinejad's two-term presidency is coming to the end, they have aspirations to present a candidate in the next presidential election who will continue the Ahmadinejad sort of line of thinking, ideologically, politically. But there's a counter-movement that has emerged that is trying to rein him in because he's viewed to be too independent. And so what Ahmadinejad has been seeking to do in terms of using leverage that he has to try and advance the cause of his own political campaign is to really send a subtle message to the Supreme Leader and to the camp of the Supreme Leader that, look, I have a lot of state secrets that I can reveal to the public that would be deeply embarrassing to the integrity of the Islamic Republic. So don't push me too far, or I will start revealing these secrets, as he did last week. In other words, secrets that deal with the high level of corruption, the nepotism, the cronyism, which exists in all authoritarian states, including Iran, where there's a lot of money because of the sale of oil. And so that's the game that he's playing right now. He's saying that, look, you know, if you try and sort of restrict my movement, if you prevent me from running a candidate in the next presidential election, I have a number of cards that I'm going to play that will embarrass you. So just be careful. So that's, I think, what's really going on here between the camp of Ahmadinejad and the camp of the Supreme Leader.
And again, I'm speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. And we're talking about the mudslinging that's going on ahead of the elections in June in Iran between the Speaker of the Parliament, who is close to the Supreme Leader, and the outgoing President, Ahmadinejad. And of course, he doesn't have a lot of ability to the clerics choose the next leaders. But is this all? This seems to be all happening in a broader geostrategic problem that Iran is having. You know, they're faced with a major setback in Syria, which could also translate into a breakup of Iraq, which is their major prize. I mean, thanks to the stupidity of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Iraq was sort of handed to Iran. But I think if Syria falls, that could have a ripple effect. The Sunni in Iraq are already very restive, and the Kurds in the north haven't been getting any oil revenue. So that place is a real tinderbox. So is this to say that the IRGC, the Kurds, the leadership, are all somewhat in disarray?
Well, I think they're facing a number of sort of different pressures. I think what we just talked about are sort of the internal domestic pressures and struggles over the future of the Islamic Republic, different sort of constituencies, which really, if you boil it down, they're different sort of rival mafia sort of groups that have an extensive sort of patronage clientel network that they're trying to preserve for their own supporters. So there's that internal battle that's going on between, you know, different factions within the Islamic Republic of Iran. But at the same time, as you said, all this is happening in the context of a broader geostrategic sort of set of developments in the Middle East that does not look very good for Iran's national interests, particularly the case of Syria. If Assad falls, that would result in a huge setback for Iran's regional influence. Just the other day, a senior clerical figure in Iran gave a speech where he basically said that Syria is Iran's 35th province, that we will not let it go, that it's so vital to Iran's national interest that they will use everything at their disposal to preserve the Assad regime. Just today, there's reports of Hezbollah forces supported by Iran entering into the war in Syria on behalf of the Assad regime. So Iran is very worried about what's happening to its regional influence. And on top of that, you know, the Arab Spring developments have been, if one is honest about it, have been basically a setback for Iran, because you have other nationalist forces that are coming to power who are really saying that, look, the Islamic Republic of Iran is not our model for political development, for a political system. We really look to Turkey and that form of that model of mixing religion and politics is much more of a model that political Islamist forces in Egypt and Tunisia seek to aspire to, and that Iran is not some country that emerging religious-based parties want to emulate. So Iran knows that, and it's very worried about its declining influence. And of course, at an international level, there's the ongoing sort of crisis and conflict with the United States, the possibility of a war breaking out, the possibility of an attack on Iran's military nuclear sites, and also, and most importantly, the increasing sanctions that are really taking a heavy toll on Iran's economy and on the quality of life and the standard of living of most average Iranians. So these things are happening all at the same time.
Well, my understanding, Nada Hashimi, is that when you mentioned that Ahmadinejad, who is quite reviled in the West, and it's hard to get your head around the idea that in this struggle he may actually be more progressive than the Supreme Leader, or less conservative. You know, it's hard to know. And I welcome your comments on that. But
yeah, no, I wouldn't sort of view this as sort of a choice between a good side and a bad side. Basically, these are two factions who basically have their own extensive sort of patron clientele networks that are deeply implicated in all of the human rights abuses in the Islamic Republic of Iran, fighting for political power. In one sense, I guess if one wanted to spin it, Ahmadinejad does have a particular anti-clerical bent toward his political orientation, but not because he's in favor of, you know, freedom of religion, or he is against sort of clerical hegemony. He was very comfortable working with clerical figures in Iran when he was advancing his own personal and political career. So there is a tension between the camp of the Supreme Leader, which is much more dominated by clerical figures, and those of Ahmadinejad, who tend to comprise mostly laymen. But none of them are standing for any sort of progressive political principles that come anywhere close to what you and I would consider to be democratic or respectful of universal human rights standards. So I think that has to be clear. This is sort of an internecine sort of hardline conservative struggle for political power inside the Islamic Republic between two nefarious sides, and it's really debatable which side is worse.
And my understanding is that amongst the educated and urban Iranians, they basically despise the clerics. So that's a whole seething part of Iran's polity that we don't hear much about since the Green Movement.
Well, that's true. I mean, because, you know, Iran has had a very bitter experience over the last 33 years. Religion has been in political power. Clerics have been in political power. A new generation has emerged after the revolution that has no memory of life before the revolution, and so you know, the demographic figures are about 2/3 of Iranians are under the age of 30. They have known nothing but clerical political rule, and so Iran had and it still has a sizable middle class, and so there are aspirations for freedom and for self-determination that are being blocked by the current regime in power, which is dominated by clerics, and so that leads to a particular anti-clericalism. That's simply, I think, a natural reaction to the state of politics in Iran, and it's very deeply felt and widespread. But it's also important to point out that this regime in Iran is also very critical and goes to extreme lengths to prevent alternative interpretations of Islam from emerging. There are a number of senior clerics who have much more democratically friendly interpretations, more human rights friendly interpretations of Islam, that the regime does not allow their voice to be heard on state television or radio. They're silenced, they're put under house arrest. And so the regime is very fearful of alternative interpretations of religion emerging, because it bases its legitimacy on the claim that it embodies Islamic authenticity and there is only one interpretation of Islam. And if you oppose the Islamic Republic of Iran, then you cannot be a good pious and practicing Muslim, and so it uses the theme of religion. It cynically manipulates it to preserve its own stranglehold on society, particularly among the poor and more religiously devout segments of society. So it plays a very cynical game, and it's fundamentally, I think, what we're seeing in Iran right now. If one sort of looks at sort of the evolution of the Islamic Republic over the last 33 years, particularly over the last 4 years since the events of 2009, the regime is suffering a huge crisis of legitimacy. It knows this, and it goes to extreme lengths to censor, to prevent the dissemination of free ideas, to block satellite television, to prevent, for example, the BBC Persian service from being, you know, broadcast into Iran, simply because the BBC broadcast service is doing sort of a really good job in reporting the news, and the regime can't tolerate an honest assessment and interpretation of the news. And so I think these are all signs of a regime that are sort of struggling to preserve itself. And ironically, what's really keeping this regime alive is the threat of an external military strike from the United States, which the Islamic Republic uses routinely to justify its own existence, to rally people around the flag, to claim that it is the embodiment of preserving Iran's national independence and integrity against predatory foreign powers that are trying to subvert and subject and humiliate Iran. And so, ironically, I would argue that U.S. foreign policy, actually, both the past and in the present, is actually playing into the hands of the clerical regime and actually strengthening it in ways that are, I think, very destructive for pro-democracy forces within the country.
Well, my understanding, when you mentioned earlier, Nada Hashemi, that Ahmadinejad is conducting a kind of veiled blackmail against the supreme leader in this spat that they're having, that he's got a lot of secrets that could embarrass them, embarrass the regime. My understanding is, for example, that when Ahmadinejad last came to the United Nations, his private cinematographer, who traveled with him everywhere, defected to the West with enormous defected to the United States, presumably to the CIA, with enormous amounts cards, you know, memory cards from cameras, etc. Of high-level inspection trips to the underground nuclear facilities, accompanied by the supreme leader, etc., capturing all their conversation, this kind of stuff. So do you know anything about the extent to which that sounds like it's more of an embarrassment to Ahmadinejad, but do you know anything more about these reports?
No, I don't, but you are right. There was a report that a photographer, or I think he was a videographer, who was with Ahmadinejad and his entourage when he came to the United States last time in September, did defect. I have not heard of reports that you've just mentioned of him bringing with him all of these video images and videotapes of visits to nuclear sites that could prove embarrassing. I suspect he probably did have those with him. If he was the official sort of photographer or videographer of the president of Iran, I'm sure he had access to those images. And if he did, he probably turned them over to the United States, which they're probably viewing or have viewed already. But you hearing it from you is the first time I've actually heard those reports, but they seem perfectly realistic given the fact that there was this high-level defection, and what exactly was brought with this defector is unknown to me. But I mean, I think that's what you've just stated is perfectly within the realm of the possible.
Well, just in closing, Nada Hashemi, given that the clerics just vet the candidates they're not likely to have anybody that's not a hardliner. What do you expect? Just more of this? I guess what we talked about earlier is that the bigger picture, if Syria falls, etc., are going to have more impact. But just in terms of the June elections, what do you expect?
Well, I'm expecting that they're going to try and make sure that what happened 4 years ago does not repeat itself. In other words, the number of candidates who are allowed to run for office are going to be carefully selected so that all of them are strong loyalists of the supreme leader. But here's the catch. The Islamic Republic of Iran is in a dilemma here because it tries to use presidential elections to generate a huge public turnout to send a message to the West that Iran does have strong popular support. Now, this time around, it's going to be much more difficult for them to do so. One, because of the Arab Spring, the global spotlight now is on authoritarian regimes and supportive of popular sort of pro-democracy movements in the region. So the regime is much more sensitive to ensuring a high voter turnout as a way of sending a message to the Western world that we are not like Mubarak, we're not like other authoritarian regimes, we're not like Assad, we do have popular support. But the regime can't generate popular support to come out to the voting polls unless it actually broadens the political sphere and allows for a range of candidates to run for political office that actually give voters a choice. And the dilemma here is that's what the regime tried 4 years ago. It did allow for Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi, two prominent reformist candidates, to run, thinking that they would be loyal sort of stooges of the supreme leader. But when the election results were announced and they were widely perceived to be fraudulent, these opposition leaders, reformist leaders, spoke out against the election, defied the supreme leader, and Iran descended into its biggest sort of post-revolutionary crisis in 33 years. So this is the dilemma facing the regime coming in the coming sort of months as we head to the June election. How do you ensure a huge popular turnout as a way of shoring up its own credibility and sending a message to the West? But how do you do it? How do you do it in a way that you don't allow for a repetition of what happened 4 years ago? So this is the big sort of crisis that the regime is facing. Just today it was announced that the Supreme Leader was meeting with senior reformist figures at his office, I suspect trying to coerce or coax them into running for political office. But of course, the consensus among the reformist movement, the Green Movement in Iran, is that there's going to be no participation in fraudulent elections while there is no freedom for political parties, while the leaders of the Green Movement are in jail, while there's no freedom of the press. So, I mean, this is the big sort of dilemma that the Islamic Republic is facing as we head toward the June election.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nader Hashimi.
Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashimi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, the Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the latest UN report on the worsening civil war in Syria that's cost 70,000 lives so far and is becoming increasingly sectarian.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله‌گاه من شده خاک کوی
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure being with you.
And the UN report just came out today about this terrible war that's cost 70,000 lives so far and is becoming increasingly sectarian. This has prompted Carla Del Ponte, the UN human rights investigator, to tell the UN Security Council that it's time to refer the issue to the issue of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Of course, Joshua, that's dead on arrival, is it not, because of the veto power of Russia and China?
It is indeed, and it complicates the situation because there are so many human rights violations on both sides of this war. As it becomes nastier and nastier, we've seen people executed, prisoners executed, torture, rape. This has descended into, you know, very difficult to adjudicate and for foreigners to adjudicate from afar in this way.
So obviously the preponderance of violence has come from the government from day one, and they've been using an air force to bomb hospitals. Yeah. universities, people lining up at bakeries. They seem to have really gone after specific high death toll targets in a way. And you're correct in as much as we've seen video of massacres on both sides. Tell us though about this. There's what is starting to develop now, at least it seems to me, that there's a kind of a war within this war, a war between the Sunni extremist al-Nusra militia and the extremist Shiite militia Hezbollah.
Well, we are seeing Hezbollah has had a number of people die, and indicating that they're playing an increasingly important role. And there are a number of Shiite villages into Syria along the Lebanese border. And Hezbollah has moved out into these Shiite villages and is protecting them. And as revolutionary activity moves from town to town, it's run into a roadblock at the Shiite villages, which are becoming increasingly militarized. And Hezbollah has moved across the border. Hezbollah is also, we believe, training Shabiha and advanced sort of militias in Lebanon. In Syria.
Well, the Shabir are the death squads, the ghosts they call them, right?
Ghosts. They're militias that have been put together, civilian militias that have been put together under the leadership of mostly relatives of the president Bashar al-Assad to bolster the military. Because as Sunnis defect from the military and the military becomes smaller, there is this effort to recruit Alawites in particular and other minorities into these irregular squads that are policing towns and quarters of the cities.
So there's no way to get a real handle on where this stands militarily, right? My understanding is that essentially the line has been held in Damascus by the 4th Division. That's the son, the brother of Bashar al-Assad, Mahar, and that's the only unit that the army more or less has left, is it? So it seems like...
Well, I wouldn't say that. The military still has quite a bit of power. What we've been seeing is in the north of the country, around Aleppo, Idlib, the border with Turkey, which is about 530 miles long, stretching from the Mediterranean coast right over to Iraq. All along that border, Syria has been falling out of control of the military. The east, in Jazeera, by Iraq, where Kurds live, has fallen out of control, and increasingly, the military has been withdrawing from the east and moving towards the main cities, Aleppo, Homs, Hama, and at Damascus, that run down the center of Syria. And so the regime is consolidating in the center of the country, around Damascus, Homs, Hama, and on the coast, where the Alawites are a compact minority. And it's been abandoning the north and the east of the country. So you're seeing, really, the emergence of a civil war in terms of the country dividing in two. The Syrian Air Force can still bomb all these regions at will. So it's not really a Benghazi situation as you had in Libya, where you have a liberated territory that is unaffected anymore, where a central government can begin to emerge. So you still have a very chaotic situation in the north. In the regions that are not being taken, that are held by the rebels, it's chaos. And that's one of the reasons why the government is pounding these areas. And as you said, hitting bakeries, hitting any center of normalcy the government is hitting, because it's trying to set up a stark contrast. Rebel-hold territory, chaos, criminality, no services. Government-held territory, we're still paying salaries, there's some semblance of normalcy, and this is the way the government is trying to keep people from defecting to the other side. And It is really a scorched earth policy, as you pointed out in the beginning, and it's leaving Syrians, you know, terribly disheartened because their country is being destroyed.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. I've heard, Joshua, that that a lot of the Alawites are looking to the Latakia coastal area and the mountains, the coastal mountains there, as a kind of final redoubt. Is that going on? Or are they still confident that they can hold on?
Well, I think that there's very divided opinions here, and the Alawites are a compact minority. In other words, most Alawites live in the coastal mountains that stretch between Lebanon and Turkey on the Mediterranean coast. Now, as you know, during the 20th century, many moved out into Damascus and some of the other cities. But increasingly, those populations that have moved into Damascus, Homs, Hama, have retreated. They sent their families back to the coastal regions where they think they'll be safe. And they're holding on to the cities. But it's going to be a long, drawn-out battle. And there is, you know, most people believe that if the Syrian army, which is increasingly becoming an Alawite-directed military, now there's still important, you know, numbers of Sunnis and others who are fighting in the Syrian army. So it's not a completely sectarian war yet. But as they get pushed out, they will have to fall back to where their families are along the coastal region. And then they will fight tooth and nail to protect their families. And that will be a very difficult fight because the Syrian opposition says they do not want to talk to Assad and any kind of compromise that leaves the Assad family in charge is unacceptable to the opposition. That's their stand today. But that means they really have to march in to this coastal region, even if the military falls back to it, and hunt Assad down and destroy his family and destroy what remains of the Syrian army. And that means no battle until complete victory. There is not a real compromise because most people think that Assad will hang in there, that he wants to defend his family and most of the regime members who fought for him around this kernel of regime, and that if he lays down his arms, all those people are going to be killed for war crimes. Therefore, he can't lay down his arms. And that means that the opposition has to go in, find him, and destroy him.
So, Joshua Landis, I've spoken to the spokespeople, the English-language spokesperson for the coordinated committees of the opposition, and they've for some time been expressing confidence in that once that they will win, and furthermore that once Assad goes, all of the problems will go away, and that the idea that that there are these kind of jihadis coming in, the Salafists, like the al-Nusra Front, are not a big problem and they can control them. But the more reports you hear about who is doing the main fighting, you get the impression that the al-Nusra, the Salafists, who are clearly getting money from the Saudis and from the Gulf, and I believe now they're getting some advanced anti-tank weapons from Kosovo or from the Armenian mafia or something, you know, it's one of the speculations. So the CIA is supposed to be in there trying to figure out a way to arm the right people, if you will, in the opposition. And that's been, been a contentious issue all along for the British, the French, and the Americans, and the Saudis. So it's a very murky picture about who's getting what arms. Do you have anything clearer than I've been sketching out here?
Well, there are, you know, by most estimates, there are about 1,000 militias operating in Syria. Now, there have been emerging some important fronts that are dominated by a few large militias. There's the Islamic Front, which is Salafist, as you've been pointing out, and al-Nusra is working in tandem with them. And then there's something called the Liberation Front, an Islamic Liberation Front, but that is working closer and more closely with the West. And it's clear that the West is trying to keep arms directed towards the more secular people. Now, we have to, you know, underline more secular because almost everybody that are on the ground, all the militias that are doing the heavy fighting, are Islamic in one way or another. And there is not, I think, you know, the West has to come to grips with the fact there's not going to be a secular answer to Syria, just as there hasn't been in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. This Arab Spring is, you know, increasingly we're discovering, is about empowering Islamists. And that is happening in Syria, and it's happening in a way that is quite scary for the West, because the Islamist militias are the ones that are gaining the greatest respect. They're doing the most fighting. They are the best trained and the most lethal. So, you know, many people say because the West hasn't armed secular militias, that the Islamists have really taken over the scene. And the longer the West does nothing, the more powerful they'll become. And it's the men with the guns in the end who are going to rule future Syria. But it's unclear that the West could control the outcome of this battle. We tried to control Iraq. We tried to control Afghanistan. And we haven't had a lot of luck doing it. Now, it's easy to say if we'd only done X, Y, and Z, everything would have been hunky-dory in Syria. Unlikely to be the case. But we've seen this factionalism, which has really turned Syria into a killing ground, because it isn't an easy fight. And the government has been able to divide and rule, but the government is crumbling. The Syrian army is slowly retreating towards Damascus and the coastline. But there's still a lot of fight left in that Syrian army. And because, as you underlined in the beginning, it's becoming increasingly sectarian, neither side wants to give up because they see this as an existential crisis and as a sort of zero-sum game. So long and bloody, I think, is the future.
So could it, just in the last minute, could it be end up as a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean?
You know, it could. Syria has been a country and a nation state for some time now, and it's likely that we will see the Sunni militias coalesce increasingly. And we're already beginning to see it at these few major fronts that are emerging. It is likely that the Sunni Arabs, the 70% of the Syrian population, will increasingly find some kind of, even if a difficult unity, will find some sort of unity. That still leaves 30% of the country. Minorities and the Kurds, 10% Kurds who live in the northeast and who would like to have autonomy. So the battle, as you underlined earlier, even once the Assad regime falls, should it fall, and when it falls, there's going to be still many battle lines that will divide Syria.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.